The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Simon Raymond. Simon is an English musician and record producer and is perhaps best known for being the bass guitarist and keyboard player with the Scottish band Cocteau Twins. He co-founded Bella Union Records, which represents artists including Father John Misty, Fleet Foxes and Beach House, and his new memoir, In One Ear, Cocteau Twins, Ivor Raymond and Me, is out now. Simon, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Simon, it's lovely to have you here. Let's start where we always do, at the very beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
Earliest memories of food? Well, my mum was a fantastic cook, so I guess I was born lucky. We had four in the family, so my elder brother and two older sisters. So being the youngest, I probably was like spoilt rotten by everybody. My earliest memories of food in the 60s probably, lots of sort of homemade shepherd's pies, that kind of thing. I think food was just less sophisticated than it is now. We didn't really do takeaways or anything like that back then. It was mostly just home-cooked food. So I kind of grew up with, you know, well-cooked stuff like your mum makes.
And Simon, your father, Ivor, was a very successful composer and he had Polish heritage. Was there any Polish influence on the food that you were eating growing up?
A lot of Jewish food, yes. My mum wasn't Jewish, my dad was. So his side of the family, when they invited us up to Muswell Hill or North London, where they all lived, we were treated to some of the most incredible Jewish food. And I still kind of dabble in it now. I love stuff like that.
What kind of dishes?
Well, I like chopped egg and onion because I'm vegetarian. So I used to love all the stuff like gefilte fish, you know, beautiful Jewish food like that. But I, being now a veggie, I just stick with the
At what point did you become vegetarian? Is that what stage was that?
When I met my wife. At that time, she was vegan in 2011. So I just thought, it makes sense if I'm vegetarian too. And then she lapsed a little bit on the veganism, and now we're just both vegetarian.
And when you were living at home as a child, what did mealtimes look like? Were they very ritualistic or frenetic? What was it like for you?
Yeah, not structured in any way. I think when you've got a father who's rarely home, is always away working, you know, older sisters coming in at all hours, an older brother who rarely sat at the table for longer than 5 minutes, being such a fidget, you just ate when you could, really. I do remember one awful incident with food where my mum put down a plate of fish and kind of a parsley sauce, you know, a bit like the boil in the bag stuff you used to get. I don't know if it was that, but it had loads of bones in it. And I don't know, I was probably 7 or 8 and I just didn't want to eat it. So I just said, thank you, I'm full, I don't want to finish it. And my mum was like, you will sit at the table until you're finished. And I just like cried for like an hour and I never finished it. And I probably stayed there for 2 hours, just staring at the food and pushing the peas around the plate. It was terrible. I've not really liked fish ever since.
That was a bit traumatic.
Yeah.
We always like to ask about school food. And I think I'm right in saying that in your memoir, you dedicate the first chapter to your experience at boarding school. What was the food like at that stage of life?
Yeah, it wasn't the first chapter, but it's one of the early chapters. And yeah, boarding school food. Well, where do you start? All the stuff you'd imagine. Breakfast, obviously, you're getting up at 7 o'clock, 7:30 in the morning, going down to breakfast. Fried bread, you know, hash browns, terrible fried eggs, terrible hard sausages. Baked beans, of course. Sometimes I think there was cereal, but I think cereal was just not really on the table. Mm. So that was breakfast. Lunch was sometimes spaghetti bolognese, but mostly just hideous pies. I mean, it is not inspiring, you know, when you're feeding 2,000 people. You can't really imagine the chefs are able to create anything particularly...
It must be a really hard job catering for that many children, because it's not
It was all split into houses, to be fair. So our house was like, I think, 200 people, but still there's one or two people making food for 200 people. So they're just doing it in a massive big pot and throwing stuff in. So, you know, you're never going to fall in love with food at school. I like the puddings. I liked, you know...
people often say that on this podcast, actually.
Crumble and custards. I think because they're sweet and you're a kid and you're running
getting
about.
Getting to the end of the meal.
Yeah, exactly. You just want to get up and go and play with your mates. So, yeah, no, I was never inspired by food at all until I was much, much older, yeah.
When you left school, were you able to cook at all? What did food look like in your life at that point?
Well... Cooking wasn't a highlight, no, because I think my first flat was literally a room the size of a closet with a kind of Calagas kind of cooker. So I think the best you could do on there would probably be beans on toast. But I think, you know, when you're sort of student age, you know, you're fine with that really, aren't you? Because you're too busy living your life to be thinking too much about food. But living in London... I lived in Earl's Court area when I was 18 for the first few years. You know, there's just so much food around, so many takeaways popping up around that time that I don't think I ate in an awful lot. Getting into music, going out to gigs every night. Food is just something you kind of chuck in as fuel for what you're about to do in the evening. So curries, fish and chips, that kind of thing. Just terribly unhealthy food. Yeah.
And in the 80s, when you were in London, you were first of all part of a band called Drowning Craze before you then met the other members of the Cocteau Twins. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about that stage? And for listeners who might not be aware, like, what was going on in your life at that point and how you ended up forming those bands?
Well, yeah, and I was living in this kind of bedsit in Earl's Court, and I used to go every day. I would go to the Beggar's Banquet record shop in South Kensington, where I would shop for my favourite music, 7-inch singles generally, because that's about all I could afford. And I used to hang about in there pretty much most days of the week. And I think after a while, the manager just said, look, you know more about this stuff than I do. Why don't you just come and work here? And I was like, seriously? I couldn't believe it. This is like my dream job, you know, working in a record shop. So I started there on a Saturday. And then after a few weeks, he asked me to come and work full time. So when I'm 18, I'm now working in this beautiful record shop. And above the record shop was three record labels, 4AD, who I obviously later became involved with Cocteau Twins, Situation 2, who my little band Drowning Craze signed to a few months later. And really that shop, I would say, is the reason I'm sitting here with you now. Everything that happened to me started in that shop. So I never underestimate the significance of it.
And so you formed these bands through a meeting in the shop. What were the discussions going on at that point?
Well, you know, I mean, at 18 years old, all I was interested in was in music. I wasn't interested in anything else.
Mm.
So every night we'd be going to a gig. You know, this is around the time when Joy Division are playing, Echo and the Bunnymen, Teardrop Explodes, Wire, Buzzcocks, New Order. You know, everybody that I'm still crazy about.
Mm.
Was coming up around about then. All these great records were coming out. You couldn't fail to be excited and influenced by it if you were interested in music. And playing in bands, trying to learn your instrument and get better at what you do, that was really all I was thinking of, and trying to make a career out of music. I mean, career was probably a bit of a stretch, because I think at 18, you're not really thinking about career, you're just thinking about fun and enjoying yourself with your friends. And that's what I think I was trying to do.
You've spoken about some turbulent times during your time with the band. It must be very stressful to be in such close proximity with the people that you work with when you're touring and when you're effectively living in each other's pockets. How was that?
Well, when it's all going great, it's the best job in the world, right? You know, you just come from school, you just come from your first job. All you wanted to do was be in a band and playing shows in front of people, making records. And then you're in the back of a cheap little van, trawling up and down the motorway and going over to Europe and playing in wonderful places you've never been to. You are living the dream, although it's a very low-class dream. You know, there's no glamour to it at all at this level. But it is all I wanted to do at that point. And obviously, the success of Cocteau Twins was quite rapid. Once I joined the band in 1983, you know, the next few years, within a year, we're in America. A year after that, we're in Japan twice. Things were moving very fast back then, and it's an entirely different record industry we live in today than was back in the 80s. So it was thrilling, absolutely thrilling.
And can you talk a bit about what the kind of food is like on tour? Do you go to restaurants wherever you end up, or does the manager sort of make sure you guys are all well fed? How does that work?
I mean, a lot of it is budget related. You know, if you're playing a tour that's getting well paid, you're playing shows that have decent fees, you're going to be taken to better places. If you've got promoters and record companies that want to take you out and show you a good time, you're probably going to get taken to nice restaurants. Certainly in Japan, that for me, that was a massive revelation. I'd never even thought about going to Japan as a 21-year-old man. And there I am eating some of the most beautiful food. I couldn't really believe it. It was a real culture shock, just the whole experience of going to Japan. And that definitely opened my eyes to, you know, the different types of cuisine that there are around the world. And certainly for the next however many years, 14 years traveling with my band, you know, I did get to experience something. But, you know, in the reality is, if you're traveling across America on a 30-date tour and you're on a bus and you're sleeping on the bus, there's no time to eat a proper meal generally, because you arrive in a town around about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You go straight to the venue. You sound check, you maybe have a snack in the dressing room, some fruit, some crisps, whatever, a sandwich. Then you do the sound check. Then you perhaps get something to eat before the gig, but it's usually stuff that's brought in. So it's not going to be beautiful food. It's just going to be functional. And then you play the show. And then 11 o'clock, you get back on the bus, drive through to the next town. Sometimes the tour manager will order 10 pizzas to put on the bus so everyone can have something as they drive off. So that's really the life. So, I mean, I'm sure it's very different now. You know, musicians have a lot, have you know, nutritionists, and it's all a lot more sophisticated. Back in the 80s, it was just literally pizza.
And do you get to know other band? I mean, did you become friends, not necessarily from tour, but did you get to know kind of other band members, and did you socialise with them, and how did that side of things work?
A little bit, but we were very antisocial as a band. We were quite very private. We were sort of seeking our own space all the time, seeking our own studios. When we had our own studios, we did improve things. We did cook a lot more ourselves in the studio, in the kitchens. So food, obviously, as you get older, as your status gets a bit higher and your income improves, you're able to buy better products, you know, better produce. So for sure, as we get into our 30s, the standard of food and our interest in food no doubt increased.
And when you were away on tour, did you miss anything food-wise?
That's a good question. Not, I mean, when I was in America, I missed British chocolate. So I can't stand American candy, American chocolate. It's nasty. I don't know what it is they put in it. So I'd miss, you know, a Twix. But food, no, I wouldn't really miss food, because I wasn't that obsessed with food when I was, you know, younger. So I think I was just really loving the experience of trying different things in each place that I would be going to.
What was the point when you realised you wanted to also go into producing music as well as making your own music?
Probably at the end of the band. Once the band broke up in 1997, and I was like, oh, I guess I need to do something different. I think that's when having your own studio meant that I was able to do that. Obviously knew what I was doing a bit more by that point. But I mean, I've never sort of done one thing exclusively over another. If someone asks me to produce their record, I'll think about it. And if I like them and feel that I can contribute something meaningful, then I'll do it. But if I don't, I'll just say, I think you can do it yourselves fine. You don't need me, or I don't think my skills are quite right. Because I'm more of a kind of sit at the back guy and throwing suggestions and helping them enjoy the process of making music, rather than, I'm not very technical on that side of things, or I wasn't back then. So I just always do things based on whether I feel like it's a good fit, or whether I'm going to enjoy the experience, or whether they're going to enjoy the experience. I think that's what producing should be about.
Mm. And what are you most proud of producing?
Probably the Lost Horizons album I made at home during lockdown in quiet moments. And I made it with my old friend Richie from another 4AD band back in the day called Diff Jazz. And we hadn't seen each other in about 20 odd years. And you know how we all were during lockdown. It was, what are we going to do now? You know, I can't watch any more TV.
You made Sourdough, but you produced an album.
Did that too. Walk the dog a lot. But yeah, I made an album. My mum had passed away in 2017, and she left me a little bit of money, and I built a studio in the garden, and that became my sort of sanctuary, and that became where I went to every day. And before I knew it, I'd finished a double album, and I thought, well, normally I would get someone else to mix it because that's a skill set that I had never really pursued before, and I thought, well, it's just music. I'm sure I can do it myself. So I just worked incredibly hard at learning the skill, because it is a different part of your brain you're using. When you're mixing a record, you're zooming in on the granular detail of every single instrument in a very different way than when you're just creating, because creating is just all about the fun of it and thinking of how this would go with that. When you're mixing, you've got to go into every single detail to the finite degree, and I wasn't sure I was going to be able to do that, because I'm very impatient. But I've actually really loved it, and I think it's the best sounding record I've ever been involved with. So I'm really proud of it, and I couldn't say that about all the records I've been involved with.
You live in Brighton now, and you have your own record shop. Does that feel like coming full circle in your music journey?
Absolutely. It was one of the very first things my wife and I discussed when we met. We met for the first time in Canada in 2011, and we went on our first few dates, which were in record shops. And we always talked how beautiful it would be to have one day. Bit of a pipe dream, really. But as we were living in London at the point when we first met, I don't think I ever thought that would be possible because of the rents and how expensive London is. But when we moved to Brighton, it was like, wow, everything's a lot cheaper here. And we found a shop for, I think it was £8,000 a year. I mean, it's literally tiny. You could swing a cat in there just about. But it was perfect for us because all we wanted to do was have a record shop that sold the stuff on the record label, nothing else. We didn't want to compete with other record shops. We just wanted to have stuff that sold, a shop that sold our own stuff. And that really worked well. We've moved to a slightly bigger premises now, but yeah, I think it's one of the most important things we've done was open that shop.
Can you talk a little bit about your memoir, Simon, which is out now? The title is In One Ear, Cocteau Twins, Ivor Raymond and Me. So perhaps you could talk a bit about your father's legacy and his influence on you, because he's obviously in the title of your book. So.
Yeah, I'd love to. Well, obviously growing up as the son of the guy that wrote I Only Want to Be With You was a thing. But I have to say that I wasn't really that into music until I was 15 when punk happened. You know, when the Sex Pistols came to town and the Clash came to town, that's when I was like, oh, this is for me. This is my entry point to music. I wasn't really that bothered before. My sisters were all listening to, you know, the pop music of the time, and my brother was playing guitar and stuff. So there was music all around the house, but I was more interested in hanging out with my friends and playing football. So my dad was away a lot, and I hardly knew him, really, if I'm honest. You know, he died very young, and whilst I loved him and he was a great guy, I can't say I really knew him. We didn't bond particularly over much, maybe Spurs. We both loved Spurs. He took me to Spurs a couple of times. And we both loved Muhammad Ali. But those are the only two things I could think of when I was writing about the book. I was writing about him in the book. I don't really know anything. So I suppose after he passed away and I was running Bella Union and I'd been doing it for a while, I got to about, I don't know, 40, 45 years old. I'm 62 now. I was like, I need to find out more about this guy because I know all the headlines. I know he wrote Dusty Springfield songs. I know he did the string arrangements for the Walker Brothers. I know he worked with Bowie. I know all the headlines that everybody else knows, but I want to know more. I want to know about all of the little fine details. So I went on YouTube late every night before bed and just started searching Ivor Raymond. And once you'd go past 200 pages where it's just all the foreign language versions of I Only Want to Be With You, I would find videos with views of only 23 of songs that I'd never heard before. And that there was the gold dust. And I started making notes and listening through to all the tracks. And then I started going onto Discogs, which is like a site where you can buy records from the past in mint condition. And I started collecting them. And I slowly started to build up a completely different image of him than I had previously. I also went down and spoke to my mum, and she gave me a bunch of tapes that he had left. He was writing a book about his life when he died. So I all of a sudden started learning an awful lot more about his life and his work.
And how was it different to what you'd thought it would be?
Well, because I didn't realise how fascinating it was, all the stuff he'd done. He was in a jazz trio on the Queen Mary, going from Southampton to New York when he was in his 20s. He was in the mines during the war. I didn't know any of this stuff. I should have, because he's my dad, but I don't know whether it's my own selfishness from the punk days onwards and not really being interested in what my parents were doing or their lives, that I maybe just bypassed it all. And then when I finally sort of grew up a little bit and thought, wow, I don't know anything about this wonderful guy. So it was a revelation, the whole thing. And I obviously enjoyed writing about that, enjoyed delving into it, and just found out some of the most incredible stuff, which is in the book.
And tell us about what food looks like for you now. Are you now a keen cook, or are you still sort of reliant on ready-made stuff like you were previously?
No. Me and my wife I wouldn't say we're foodies, but we do make a lot of food. But given that we're both in the music business and we both are out at gigs probably 3 or 4 times a week, I would be lying if I said I came home every night and cooked, because it's just not always possible, because sometimes you get in and you got to go straight back out. So all you're going to do is either grab something or get a takeaway. So we still do eat a lot of takeaway stuff just out of necessity. But, you know, the standard of takeaway these days is phenomenal. Street food as well. There's an incredible chicken shop in Brighton called The Box Shop, which is kind of a cross of Asian and South American influence. So it's absolutely beautiful. And we're both vegetarians, so they do these kind of vegan tenders. So we have that. We make our own salads. We make our own veg. So I make soups. My wife's a brilliant cook. We do eat a lot of the same food several times a week. We're a bit OCD like that. So, like, I'm quite happy to have the same dinner 3 or 4 times a week. Sounds quite weird, doesn't it? But I am a bit like that. It's almost like a comfort thing, maybe. A Dishoom. I'm a massive Dishoom fan. Have been since about 2010.
Is there a Dishoom in Brighton?
There is now, yeah. Okay. It's like a game changer for us. So I think we went to the first Dishoom in, I think it was in Covent Garden back in, I don't know, probably 2012 when Abby first moved to the UK. And always loved it. Sort of such a beautifully different kind of Indian food, rich.
What's your go-to Dishoom order?
Well, I have the Matir Paneer because it's cheese. And we have the black bean dal, which is probably one of the greatest dishes ever invented. I mean, if we don't have that 3 times a week, then there's definitely something wrong with us.
Very good.
The black bean dal.
Simon, you've got 2 sons as well. What role has food played in kind of family life? Do you guys get together frequently, or are they off and about like you were as well?
Well, I'm very lucky that about to become a granddad for the first time. My eldest son, Stan, his partner, Georgie, is a top-notch London chef.
Oh, brilliant.
So whenever we go round to his house for Sunday lunch, we are very spoiled. But yeah, whenever we invite everyone round, my kids and their partners, then we always do a good spread. I make Thanksgiving dinner for my wife and her friends when they come over in November, and I do love doing that. I'll do the turkey, even though I'm a vegetarian, and I'll, you know, do all the trimmings. I like it. You know, I like having the family over and doing the traditional thing like my mum would have done for us. It's a beautiful thing.
We talked about school puddings a little while ago. Do you have a sweet tooth now?
I do, but I have to be very careful. Sugar and my stomach are not good friends, so I have to be careful. But yeah, I mean, if we're out at a restaurant and sticky toffee pudding is on the menu, I might indulge. But I tell you what, I went to one, my favorite restaurant in the world is in Austin, It's a Japanese restaurant called Uchiko. Now, we've been to Osteria Francescana, the most famous restaurant in the past few years in Modena, and it is beautiful. We had the most phenomenal... Abby booked it for a birthday present for me, and you had to book up, like, I don't know, 2 years in advance or something. And it's tiny. It's like a room like this. And I felt very privileged to go, and it was phenomenal. But this place in Austin... Man, the food there, if you ever find yourself in Japan, you have to, again, you have to book up long in advance because it's super popular. But the vegetarian sushi in that restaurant is to die for. It's incredible.
We normally ask what your comfort food is, but perhaps it's the same meal a few times a week. is there a particular dish that you find yourself gravitating towards, even if you then do eat it a few times in a week?
Yeah, I mean, I would say dishoom is our comfort food.
Okay, so that
because
be
if
your...
we're like on the WhatsApp at like 7 o'clock, and I'm not home yet. I'm not. What do you want to do for dinner? We don't even have to type it. Really, it's just like dishoom. And I've got the premium account, so it comes real quick.
So, you know about the cookbook?
The dishoom cookbook.
Yeah, they've got a very good cookbook.
We haven't got that yet. We will, no doubt. We've got a few cookbooks that we do delve into, but the dishoom one would be great. Maybe a Christmas present would be nice, yeah.
And Simon, to finish, we always ask what our guest's desert island meal is, which does not mean you are stranded on a desert island and have to spear your own fish. It just means, what is your ultimate meal? What would you like to eat as your final meal in a non-morbid sense?
The Last Supper, but without...
The Last Supper, but you wake up tomorrow morning as well.
That's a great question. Well, I think if I was making it myself, I would probably do some kind of Asian concoction. I do love cooking Asian food. Probably if I was eating out, it would be dishoom.
Gotta have some dishoom in there.
But I mean, I'm a big fan of Italian food, so I think I'd make some beautiful pasta as well. Yeah, maybe some homemade ravioli with a beautiful pesto sauce. I'd have to have some corn pieces in there because we obviously need some protein. That would probably do me in a beautiful salad with mandarin segments and radicchio, nice little homemade dressing. That would be the kind of thing I'd do.
Would you have pudding?
No, because I'm not going to do puddings anymore. I'm weaning myself off them.
Well, Simon, thank you for joining Table Talk today. And Simon's new memoir, In One Ear, Cocteau Twins, Ivor Raymond and Me, is out now.
Thank you very much.